This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Grocery shopping has always been a delight for me. As a kid, I would happily join along on grocery trips so I could pick out my favorite boxed brownie mix at Aldi, or occasionally steal some goodies from the bulk food section while my parents were in the other aisle. Grocery shopping is an act of discovery. And as the playgrounds and music venues shut down earlier this year, I started thinking a lot about grocery stores as a community space. But the act of sharing space with people I didn't know made the store feel super scary back in April. It was really stressful wrangling shopping lists and trying to figure out when it's least crowded or whether I should wipe down everything before I load it into the fridge. But slowly but surely, I am getting back to delighting in groceries. And as long as everyone is wearing a mask, I can really enjoy being in a building with a couple dozen people I don't know. Today, we are going to celebrate North Carolina's grocery stores and talk about how the supermarket aisle was patented as an automatic selling machine. We're also going to count your votes for the best North Carolina-founded grocery chain. To help me sort through history and myth, I'm joined by two associate professors at UNC Greensboro. Lisa Tolbert is the author of the forthcoming book, Doggeries, Jungles, and Piggly Wigglies, Southerners and the Social Landscape of Food Shopping, 1840 to 1940. Hey, Lisa, welcome to the show.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
David Gwynn is also...
My book actually has a new title.
Oh, okay, go ahead and share that with us.
It's currently called Beyond Piggly Wiggly, A Cultural History of the American Self-Service Store.
Wonderful. David Gwynn is also here with us. He is the creator of the Grocetaria website and the digital projects coordinator for the UNCG Libraries. Hey, David.
Hi, Anita. Glad to be here.
So there's so much to talk about today, and I'd love to just start by getting a sense of how you both are doing as grocery lovers in this current moment when going to the grocery store is much more fraught than it has been in times past. I'd love to start with you, David. How have you been holding up, and what's been your orientation toward grocery shopping these days?
Well, like you, I'm navigating the strange landscape of when things will be less crowded, what the best time to go, what the best days of the week to find the things that are perpetually out of stock are, that kind of thing. But I am still actually doing all my grocery shopping in person because I never warmed to the online delivery thing. And, you know, for a lot of people right now, I think going to the grocery store is sort of the one outing they get to have and not feel guilty about. So I think it's an important thing for a lot of people right now.
Most certainly. I mean, it's very much still a place where you can encounter folks that you wouldn't otherwise. And we sent out requests to a bunch of different grocery stores, called up a lot of independent grocers serving North Carolinians. And I want to start with a clip that really gets to that, the kind of grocery store as a community space. This is a store that is actually in Georgia, but provides food for folks living west of Murphy out in Cherokee County. And the cashier picked up the phone and told us about why her store is important even right now.
My name is Tanya Davis. I work at Hometown IGA in McKaysville, Georgia. We're the only grocery store. Gosh, I can't even tell you, like, Tennessee doesn't have, like, Polk County. Their grocery store got shut down about a year and a half ago. And we're the closest, I think. Thank you. We're the closest, I think, I don't know, 20. Love you, too. You would have to travel, like, 20, 30 miles to get to another grocery store from Farner, Tennessee, or Turtletown, or Ducktown. I mean, most people from Tennessee, they drive in. But we get quite a bit that do walk. Sometimes on lunch, I run a few people home if it's bad weather or not, if they come here and it starts raining. Or if somebody walks here and they get more than they had planned, some of us try to give them a ride back because, you know, where they're at. Just normally, they're just right up the hill, so it's like a few minutes. But yeah, I do get to know a lot of these folks. People been shopping here for 20, 30 years, you know, more. And Ed, the owner now, he's owned it for close to 20 years. I mean, we know everybody. Everybody, you know, there's a lot of people that shop here that used to work here when they were teenagers. And when you come to McKaysville, this is the place. I see people coming in here and say, I haven't seen you in years. I mean, this is kind of the meeting place.
And that's Tanya Davis, a cashier out near the western border with Tennessee and Georgia. So, Lisa, I'd love for you to reflect a little bit on that clip and maybe kind of what it makes you pay attention to in terms of grocery stores in this present moment when things are looking really different for people.
I mean, what it made me think of, we talked today about food deserts and neighborhoods where grocery stores are far away or rural areas and so forth. And I'm studying grocery stores in the early 20th century, and that was sort of an unheard of thing in a lot of ways because neighborhoods were grocery stores were small neighborhood businesses, and they were around every block on every corner practically. So it was a different world in terms of accessibility to grocery stores in that era.
Well, yeah. I mean, we used to be able to walk to stores, and even folks in cities maybe much more easily could go and kind of grab groceries on the way to or from work. But this idea of delivery has really popped up as being much more common now. People who don't even want to enter the store want to get their groceries delivered. And David, I'm so curious to hear that, or I'm so surprised to know that this actually existed a long time ago. People were getting their groceries delivered in the early 1900s. Tell me a bit about that early grocery delivery history.
Well, yeah, you're right. It is sort of interesting that we've sort of come full service with the whole delivery concept, because in the early part of the 20th century, delivery was almost a given for grocery stores, simply because people weren't driving to the store. They were either walking to the store in the morning and selecting what they wanted, and it would be delivered in the afternoon, or later on, you know, they were actually calling in their orders as well. And you know, by this, I mean particularly in cities. Starting around the mid-teens, there was a move afoot with some chains, A&P and the developing Piggly Wiggly as well, along with others, to sort of move away from this delivery and paying on account model, because the idea is that, you know, you could actually bring down the prices of the groceries if you weren't offering these extra services. And this sort of continued on through the 20s and 30s, and particularly into the supermarket era. So actually, the supermarkets were specifically about not providing services like this. So it's very interesting, you know, now that the big chains and the supermarkets are actually moving back into the delivery zone now, because it was really, in the early days, they were sort of a reaction to the idea of delivery and were pretty much dead set against it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that we've kind of flipped back and forth over time between really wanting to pick out our own stuff in person, handle everything, and then wanting other people to do that for us. But long before we even had those options of kind of self-service, things looked really, really different. So Lisa, maybe take us back to kind of pre-supermarket in the first place. How were people getting their ingredients in the 1800s?
Well, the self-service store first started to be created in the World War I era, and it was a very risky kind of way to try to operate a business because people were used to the conveniences of delivery, and pretty much that was an integral part of neighborhood grocery businesses. So it was self-service sort of started as an austerity war measure to lower food prices and address the labor shortage of men who had gone off to fight in World War I. And people thought it would be a short-term fad. And Piggly Wiggly, which I'm studying, the chain that I'm studying, Clarence Saunders, who invented it, managed to convince the patent office to issue a patent for his store design. And he sold it as a machine for automatic selling.
Tell me about that. What was the design? What was his philosophy behind what he was going to be able to do in these stores?
Yeah. So he was not the first to invent self-service. There were self-service stores in several different places when he first opened Piggly Wiggly in Memphis in 1916. His patented invention was a one-way pass, and you had to enter through a turnstile and go all the way through the store, which the biggest store was four aisles, and you had to pass the cashier checkout to get out of the store through the exit turnstile. And the idea was that it actually induced sales in Clarence Saunders' Saunders' words, because it, people had to look at everything in the store before they could get out.
Yeah, I mean, it reminded me when I lived in New York City, there was a Trader Joe's where you had to get in line once you entered the store. You had to basically be in line the whole time, and it forced you to walk up and down every aisle. And I cannot count the number of extra things I would always grab because you see things differently when you're forced to walk up and down every aisle.
Yeah, it really works. And that was true of a lot of self-service stores. They tended to sell more than a store like A&P, which stuck with counter service longer than other chains did. But what people were used to doing was that kind of counter service. You walk in, you hand your list to the clerk, and the clerk puts your order together. And so I agree with David. I mean, it's a really interesting thing to see us come full circle with store clerks at the supermarket, you know, with me in the aisles, rolling carts around, putting together multiple orders for people who have purchased online.
We're going to take a quick break right here, and then I will bring you both back with us after the break, and we'll talk a bit more about Piggly Wiggly and all kinds of North Carolina-based grocery store chains. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. We are celebrating North Carolina's grocery pioneers today. I'm here with grocery historians David Wynn and Lisa Tolbert. From the Ingles of the Highlands to the Supermercados of the Sandhills, we are walking the aisles of our state's finest stores. So, Lisa, I want to start back with you and talk a bit more about this innovation that swept nation stores, this transition from counter service and delivery to customers actually walking the aisles. And this was, in particular, something that caught on really quickly with women and Black folks. Tell us a bit about why that was.
Okay, so the self-service process was a very strange and new kind of process. And one of the ways that it appealed to women and to Black customers was because it depersonalized interactions in the store. In a counter service store, you went in and you had to wait in line. You had to wait at the counter. There was not really a line. It wasn't that organized. And so the clerk could make a lot of distinctions about you socially, and who got served first and what kind of service you got, how polite things were, and also even what kind of products you could get, because if the clerk was filling your order, he could reserve, outdated products for you if you, were a Black customer or, you know, not serve you the best quality. And in a self-service store, you were buying off the shelf the same brand name products that every customer bought. But I think what's the most interesting thing about the self-service store is what I'm calling the radical equality of the checkout line. The fact that you, when you reached that checkout line, which was a feature of every self-service store, the stores were so small, you really can't sort the lines in a segregated way. You can't shuffle customers. Customers are served first come, first served. And African-American customers really liked that kind of process. And it appealed greatly to them. And Piggly Wiggly actually advertised in African-American newspapers and recruited African-American customers. One of the first stores in Memphis was on Beale Street.
Hmm. Well, David, tell us a bit about, so we've been talking about Piggly Wiggly, which is not a chain that was North Carolina-based or founded, but there are a number that are. Harris Teeter, Lowe's Foods, Food Lion. Take us into some of their histories and how they come to the picture of building this historical story of supermarkets that we're talking about today.
Okay, well, you know, initially up until roughly the 1930s or so, the big chains in North Carolina were some of the larger chains that you saw around the country, like the A&P, Pender stores, which later grew into Colonial and Big Star supermarkets. But you started to see some homegrown chains developing, especially from around the 1930s on. And it's interesting that they actually developed a lot out of the chain store model. So, for example, Harris Teeter, which is, I don't know if you might think that maybe one of the best known North Carolina supermarket chains, there actually were a Mr. Harris in Charlotte and a Mr. Teeter, I believe, in Mooresville, who actually started out running their own stores. Mr. Harris had been a manager for the A&P, and when his store on Central Avenue in Charlotte was closed, he actually bought the store and decided to run it himself. And then, you know, a couple of years later, built a big new store about a block away, which became Harris Supermarket Number One, and is the store they still refer to as Harris Teeter Number One, though it's been replaced at this point. Food Lion, of course, was started in Salisbury by the Kettner family, who had actually owned small grocery stores, a chain of small grocery stores for years that sold out eventually to, if I remember correctly, to Dixie Home, which later became Winn-Dixie Stores. And then Ralph Kettner, remember that family, started over again with a whole new chain called Food Town in the 1950s, pushing the idea of low prices. And this was particularly interesting because it was a very community-based store. He actually fundraised within the community, and his initial stockholders were all people from Salisbury, most of whom became quite wealthy with their Food Town stock over the years. There's a big sense of community ownership of the Food Town and now Food Lion chain in Salisbury.
And Food Lion,
because
the
community.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I was just going to ask about Food Lion being one of the stores to really promote this idea of a discount grocery store and show the market what a discount grocery store could do, how it could operate and be successful. Take us into that a little bit, because it's really interesting.
Yeah, it was particular. Food Lion, in a weird way, when they started doing actually their big expansion around the state in the 70s, became really something of a fad. They had a jingle that used the letters LFPINC, which stood for Lowest Food Prices in North Carolina. And people were singing this jingle, and they were putting LFPINC bumper stickers on their cars. And it was just kind of crazy at the time. You know, it's like people were going hog wild over the supermarket chain that was, you know, cheaper than the others. And, you know, supermarkets are a very low margin business to begin with. So when we're talking cheaper, we're talking, you know, maybe a dime or so difference on a product. But, you know, it adds up. And Food Lion became big in North Carolina during the inflationary period. I mean, its rapid statewide growth was in the 70s, which was a period of rapid inflation in food prices. And I don't know, people felt about it very much like it was sort of a hometown chain that grew big. And you saw that a little with Piggly Wiggly. I mean, Lisa would agree with me. Piggly Wiggly was originally a discount chain, but it became sort of a trendy thing to shop there over time. And I think you see the same thing now with stores like Aldi and Lidl that were both directed at sort of the low price point of the market. But now, you know, you start seeing them moving into more upscale areas because it sort of just becomes trendy to shop there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a question of marketing. You know, who are you marketing to? How are you marketing your store? And I want to turn now and talk a little bit about independent and immigrant grocery stores in the state, those that kind of cater to a particular community but then end up serving a much greater community. We spoke with someone out in Burke County, a store that serves the Hmong community in particular, imports green tea, Kit Kats, and sources directly with local chili farmers, and spoke a bit about how the dynamics of that store came to be.
Hey, my name is Chairman. I'm with my family here. We own a store in Valdez, North Carolina. The name of our store is called Sincor Marketplace. So at first, when we first started the store, you know, they asked us, the kids. We weren't really motivated into doing it. So my parents, they basically got in touch with my mom's brothers, and they were able to, you know, look it up online, get in touch with the wholesaler. Because a lot of the local farmers, you know, that we work with, they will bring a lot of their produce in during like probably the spring, summertime, maybe into the fall. But the wintertime is usually when we aren't able to do much sourcing with the local farmers. I have met one Hmong lady here that she makes her own kimchi. I have recommended her, like, you know, hey, if she ever wanted to make kimchi, bring it to the store. She's always welcome to. It'll be a nice source of income for her. Not to mention, you know, we'll have kimchi in the store here as well. That's made locally here in the Burke County area. There's people around here that will gladly support smaller local business instead of, like, you know, having to go to where Walmart, where they can probably get it cheaper and everything.
That's Chaman talking about Sancor Marketplace, located in Valdez, just east of Morganton. I'm here with grocery historians Lisa Tolbert and David Gwynn. Lisa, I wonder if you could talk a bit about the relationship between different kinds of stores. So we've been talking about these bigger chain supermarkets like Harris Teeter and Piggly Wiggly. Then when we have these more independent grocers and these immigrant markets, is it a similar kind of supply chain, or is it a whole different way of operating a business?
Yeah, my book is called Beyond Piggly Wiggly because I'm looking at especially the important role that smaller independent grocers played in actually inventing self-service. And of course, supply chains of the early 20th century were very, very different than they are now. In terms of the warehousing and the long distance transportation, some of that had developed, but self-service stores primarily sold brand name products so they could take advantage of the advertising that food manufacturers were doing. People had to be familiar with the products when they came into the store because there wasn't going to be a lot of clerk interaction. And so that's one way they didn't sell. It was one of the things that they changed that was maybe made the self-service store risky because they didn't take in like local eggs for barter and do that kind of local exchange network. It was more of a connection to wholesalers and brand name products that were increasingly familiar to people through advertising.
David, you mentioned that the profit margins are so thin in the grocery industry. How do these family-run and smaller immigrant-run grocery stores, how do they stand out? How do they develop their clientele and make themselves sustainable?
Well, it's interesting that a lot of these chains or a lot of the smaller ethnic and independent stores actually tend to locate in former locations of chain stores. So in a way, they're sort of serving areas that the chains have left behind, which is kind of a good thing in a lot of ways because, you know, it takes us sort of away from that trend toward food deserts. So that, you know, it's a way for neighborhoods to sort of keep their smaller supermarkets. But it is interesting working for the independents because, you know, there's always the thought that the big chains can actually charge lower prices because they're doing such volume buying and they can pass those savings on. It's really less that in the supermarket industry than to some extent a big part of what cuts into the profits for supermarkets is the expenses, you know, the overhead, the corporate overhead, that kind of thing. And where the big chains have their advantages, they can spread that over a large number of stores. But there's some advantages for the independent stores too. Now, most of them, you know, tend to be affiliated now with some sort of wholesaler. So there actually is sort of a middleman, which is a lot like it was with most stores prior to the big chains taking over. You know, there were sort of these middlemen, if you will, that were acting as the wholesalers. And sometimes the wholesalers themselves own stores too. Like Lowe's Foods, for example, is owned by a big wholesaler who also supplies a lot of ethnic supermarkets around the country. And sometimes you find that these wholesalers also offer other aspects of support. So help with choosing locations, maybe locations where their corporate owned stores used to be, and with marketing, et cetera. So you see things like the voluntary chains and co-ops like IGA, Galaxy Supermarkets, that kind of thing. And actually Piggly Wiggly sort of falls under that category now as well. Does that sort of get to what you're looking at?
It definitely does. And this idea of kind of geographic division of supermarket chains also has to do with allegiances, how much a community is allied to one particular store. And there is one in Durham, an immigrant-owned grocery store that a lot of people have a lot of fond feelings about. It's called Durham Food World. And we spoke with the owner of this store a bit about what it took to open this store as a new transplant to the area. Let's listen.
When I open this store, not much client. Nobody know me. How gonna selling, what selling, nobody know. It take time, all take time. People trust me, I selling this stuff all way. It's a little bit build up, no? No one day jump up, nobody, yeah? Time. It's the best medicine, time. Mejor remedio ese tiempo ya, nada otra cosa.
That's Lee Kwan, owner of Durham Food World, which operates as a flea market style grocery store experience with leased space for a clothing vendor, a juice bar, a taqueria, and a panaderia, and serves customers from Senegal, Korea, Argentina, Mexico, and elsewhere. Lisa, this reminds me a little bit about the idea of, you know, the transition from supermarkets selling just dry goods to then folding in the butcher and folding in the dairy and folding in these kind of individual vendors who can sell things, and then the transition from that to a market that owns everything. So talk a bit about why that model of the butcher and other vendors began to disappear to this more homogenized supermarket, no vendor model.
Well, in the 1920s, as self-service kind of expanded regionally, really, most popular in California and in the South, actually. It expanded specifically selling canned groceries, prepackaged groceries. And people thought that you could not actually sell some products as self-service, and especially fresh meat was one of those. And also produce was questionable about whether it could be sold self-service. Grocers were worried about the damage people would do to their investment, for example. And in the 1920s, the newfangled thing was what was called the combination store that put under one roof the produce and the fresh meat and the groceries. But again, those were mostly sold by counter service. It's really the Great Depression where you see that move toward sort of an industry move towards self-service. So self-service is really kind of born in two different kind of economic crises. One was World War I, and the other was the Great Depression in the 30s as people shifted that way. And it wasn't until after World War II that you could just do fresh meat by self-service, really. That required a major industry reorganization. But in Greensboro in the 1930s, Piggly Wiggly opened an experimental meat counter to try to integrate fresh meat.
That does not sound good.
Well, it was for the delicate of heart, because you didn't have to actually look at bloody meat. The innovation was it's like a lunch counter. You came in and sat down at the counter and pointed to pictures of the cuts that you wanted the butcher, who was nicely behind the scenes, to cut for you in the store. And I'm really interested in all of the very creative experiments that independent stores and small stores like Piggly Wiggly, smaller chains, did to try to make self-service work in a profitable way. And it was harder than people think.
Yeah, I mean, David, we only have a minute or so left before we close out, but I wonder if you have any thoughts on how the evolving way that we have interacted with food in the grocery store, and whether we go and choose it in person or click on it online. I mean, how does it change our relationship with food to think about how close our proximity is to the groceries, whether we're looking at meat in this catalog or actually seeing it behind the butcher counter?
Well, I think, you know, a big part of it, of the move towards supermarkets and self-service meant that we were swayed by brand names and marketing more than we had ever been swayed before in the past, because you had to be. That was how you picked out these things when you didn't have a clerk telling you what you needed to buy. And that's only, and it's the same thing now. If you're buying online, you're going to buy a name that you recognize. Which means the marketing is a much bigger part of the whole relationship with food than it was years ago. And that, you know, has actually moved us further away from our food. So, you know, that tends to be the antithesis of local sourcing, et cetera. So for what that's worth.
We're going to continue our conversation just after a quick break. I will be with David Gwynn and Lisa Tolbert. And we're also going to talk with the founder of the Black Farmers Hub. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. We are celebrating North Carolina's pioneering grocery history today. It is not just Lyons, Teeters, Ingles, Lowe's, and Bylow's. We're also checking in with some of our state's independent grocers. Grocery historians David Gwynn and Lisa Tolbert will be back with me in a moment, but I'd like to introduce an independent grocer now with a long family history in the profession. Demetrius Hunter is the founder of Grocers on Wheels and the Black Farmers Hub in Southeast Raleigh's. Hey, Demetrius.
Hi.
So we were talking, good, thank you. We were talking before the break about this relationship with food and how that has evolved over time as our way of acquiring groceries has changed. Your family has a deep history with both farming and selling produce, and I know you've thought a lot about this. Take us into some of that history.
It started off with my grandfather, Lonnie Hunter. He basically was a farmer in Johnson County, sharecropper, and prior to that, of course, we know about enslavement and how our ancestors basically farmed then. But now my dad and my grandfather, they basically started out in a mule and cart. And from Johnston County to Raleigh, they delivered fresh produce to the seniors in Southeast Raleigh. And that was back in the Great Depression when communal, working together was a priority.
And that eventually evolved into you and your father driving a truck around Raleigh with produce and selling it out the back of that. So tell us about that and that experience as a kid.
Absolutely. Well, me and my father, Zeb Hunter, we went around Southeast Raleigh. He started out, of course, by himself. But as he got older, I decided to take on the responsibility to try to help them out every weekend. We started out Fridays and Saturdays up at 5 in the morning, meeting farmers for local sourcing and delivering to all the communities in Southeast Raleigh.
And how has the food landscape evolved in Southeast Raleigh over the course of your lifetime? I mean, we hear about it a lot as a food desert, as a place where it's hard to find access to local fresh food. What has been your perception of its history?
Well, as far as I remember, there was no such thing as called food deserts until 2012. Hmm. And when 2012 hit, the USDA considered Southeast Raleigh a food desert. And that's when my eye opened. My dad had retired at that time. And, you know, the community wanted someone to assist in delivering produce or making sure that we had healthy foods in the community. So we started a program called Grocers on Wheels. Grocers on Wheels served Wake County and Durham counties, primarily seniors and those who had little to no access to transportation getting to the grocery stores. So we've been currently delivering to churches, serving hotels and restaurant workers laid off, and other community organizations or individuals who may not be able to get to the store.
And you're working directly, I mean, you're interfacing one-on-one with these consumers as you were with your father when you were in the back of the truck. And so I'm guessing you've built a lot of relationships over the course of your time doing this work. And I'm curious what you feel like is maybe misunderstood about folks who are experiencing food insecurity or those who are having trouble being able to make it to the grocery store and get their own food. What do you wish people kind of better understood from your experience building relationships with various folks?
Well, the relationship for grocery stores to consumer has been a very difficult situation with the Southeast Raleigh area. two grocery stores shut down back in 2012. And the reason pretty much was they weren't making enough revenue to keep it open. So that was, you know, primarily the problem. And, you know, being that the quality of foods in the store has shifted to poor quality. And I think there's a I think the community or the grocery stores recognize now that that is a must to have quality produce in the area. So they've been working hard to make sure that that has happened. And as well as our own brick and mortar, the Black Farmers Hub, 1409 Cross Street, we in Raleigh, we basically go out early in the morning to the farmers, make sure that the produce is quality, fresh. We have a platform for vendors to make sure that they understand quality and they go through a screening so that they can actually put their foods into different stores as well. So sauces, honeys, teas, coffees, all are located at the Black Farmers Hub, and those are quality foods. So that is the main purpose of why we opened up, to build that relationship and understand, help consumers understand that what quality foods are.
And are you, is there a lot of demand for your products? I mean, you mentioned knowing that those two stores that opened shut down and there were community concerns about quality and people weren't shopping at those stores. How did you, what kind of market research did you do before opening your own brick and mortar to make sure that that wasn't going to happen to you?
Well, being that we were already out in the community, we did assessments. We worked with the county. We also worked with NC State marketing team. We did door-to-door sales, of course, and we got feedback. And, you know, in the community that I'm from, I kind of know already what a lot of people drink, eat, and what they're used to. But one of the things that we also are working on here at the Black Farmers Hub, we have at least once a month food tastings.
Hmm.
So we introduce people to new foods that they may not have had. It may be an African dish. It may be a Jamaican dish. It may be an old African-American dish from the South. Or it may just be a vegan dish. So that we are culturally making sure that we are sound with the people and what they desire to eat. And that's how we push our marketing.
That's really wonderful. And it seems like being able to, you know, see the connection between the produce that you could buy in a store and a potential final product would go a long way in encouraging folks to try out new vegetables or try out new ways of cooking and using the things in your store.
Absolutely. That is, that I guess that's the most important piece, that we introduce new foods. But the second priority for us is healthy eating. Around us in Southeast Raleigh on Cross Street is Bojangles. There's Church's Chicken. There's a lot of foods that contain grease. So one of the alternatives is to have something healthier. So we like to call ourselves the Superfoods store of Southeast Raleigh. So we have papayas, we have sea moss, we have soursop. These are superfoods, high in antioxidants, things that help reduce blood pressure, hibiscus teas. So we're working really hard to make sure that people eat healthy and have a better lifestyle as well. It's not just a culture thing, but bringing in superfoods to the community to continue to help them live longer lives.
I want to bring back in two of our grocery historians, Lisa Tolbert and David Gwynn, and share our results from our listener poll of North Carolina-founded supermarket chains, folks' favorites. We asked people to vote, and the results were a decisive victory for Harris Teeter, with Ingles coming in a close second. So I want to put that to you, David, and maybe ask you about, you know, the divides between grocery chains and, you know, folks who have really strong feelings about where they shop. How do grocery stores decide where they are going to locate, and how does that shape the kind of people that have allegiances to particular stores?
Well, it's interesting you should bring this up right after Demetrius spoke about food deserts in a lot of cities, because if you go back to the 20s, 30s, 40s, that was less of a thing because, you know, and before urban renewal, for example, decimated black business districts, there were chain grocery stores in every neighborhood of most cities. There may have been fewer stores in less affluent areas. They may not have been as nice, but they were everywhere. And that's a big thing that's changed as the store, as the chains have concentrated into these larger supermarket locations over the years. There's a much bigger investment in building a store, and they tend to build it in a place where they think they can get the most value and the most revenue, as opposed to, you know, opening a little 600 to 1,000 square foot store in the middle of a commercial district. The biggest trend I've noticed in this area over the last couple of years, though, with the marketing position, if you will, is we've sort of lost the middle. There aren't mid-range stores. There are low-price discount stores, and there are high-end stores like your Whole Foods, maybe your Fresh Markets. Even I would put Lowe's Foods in that category as well. But there's not so much of a middle, as you just saw recently in the Triangle. You lost Kroger, which was a pretty good middle ground grocer. You didn't really lose Kroger because Kroger also owns Harris Teeter, but use that middle ground of, I don't know, sort of, there's a word I'm looking for and I'm not finding it.
I know what you're saying. The middle tier grocery store in terms of how expensive things are and the kind of access to products there is. And I guess, Lisa, that brings up the question of, you know, community. I mean, where you shop and who you are able to see in the aisles is going to look different if you're at a chain that has pretty much only exclusively high-end products versus somewhere that has stuff that's all around the range and, you know, all kinds of different opportunities, different kinds of products. How do you think this development of grocery chains and this division, as David mentioned, of more high-end and then more low-end has changed the community nature of grocery stores?
I wouldn't call them community stores anymore in a lot of ways, because it would be interesting to do license plate surveys to see, you know, where in the parking lot to see where the store is pulling people in from. And neighborhoods, of course, are a very different thing. But I wanted to, piggyback on when I was listening to Demetrius talk about his experience, how much it echoes historically the importance of groceries as small businesses historically in the African-American community. The National Negro Business League in the early 20th century did a survey nationally of black businesses, and there were more grocers than any other kind of small business. And in Winston-Salem, the National Negro Business League worked with grocers, independent grocers there, to organize the second group of what they called the Colored Merchants Association. It had started in Montgomery, Alabama, but they came into Winston-Salem next, and it became an important way to do demonstrations of new brand name products like Nabisco wafers and Best Foods mayonnaise. The Winston-Salem Teachers College did lectures in a local grocery store that was a model store, Mr. Ellington's store on East 7th Street. And they did those taste testings and tried to familiarize the community with the new brand name products. It appears that the Depression sort of put that out of business. The Colored Merchants Association expanded into New York City and some other places, but the Depression really hit them hard.
Yeah, well, I'd love to just ask Demetrius about who his peers are now. I mean, do you have peers of other black grocers around the state that are trying to do similar things to you, Demetrius?
So as far as peers, we partner with a lot of the peers in the community. Fertile Ground has really been an excellent source of pulling together communal grocery stores, which is a co-op, CSAs from all over the eastern side of North Carolina. Yeah, we've worked hard with a few of the up and coming stores. I think the Eastern, I think it's called the Eastern Shore. They have like a CSA as well.
When you think about your business model as compared to some of the bigger chains we've been talking about this hour, the Harris Teeters, the Food Lions, the Whole Foods, who in this moment are able to, you know, evolve to let people pick out their stuff online, to be able to get stuff delivered by Shopt or Instacart, how are you thinking about kind of keeping your business alive and continuing to thrive in this moment when the, you know, the technology is changing and people's ability or desire to shop in different ways is evolving also?
Absolutely. We're working on a website that can allow people to do a curbside pickup, which most grocery stores have. We're a little, you know, smaller, so it's taken us time to get those things in function. But we will have a curbside pickup function on the website. They can place their order online. We can ship. That is current now. And the deliveries, of course, we've been doing deliveries in the program with Grocers on Wheels, but we'll be doing that. And we have the knowledge to at least deliver from throughout the triangle, Durham, Raleigh, you know, Apex, Knightdale. Those areas will be delivering, especially during the COVID. If the mandate hits again, where we go back into another phase that requires us to stay home as an essential business, we will, you know, make sure that we go to delivering and have the pickup in order.
Thank you all so much for joining me today. My guests were Demetrius Hunter, founder of Grocers on Wheels and the Black Farmers Hub, Lisa Tolbert, an associate professor of history at UNC Greensboro and the author of a forthcoming book, and David Gwynn, faculty at UNCG and the creator of GrossSateria.com and the digital projects coordinator at the UNCG Libraries. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find out more about the show and everyone we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.